Okay, so it took a couple of minutes to get going there. Right, so this is the third lecture today on vision. And mostly we're going to be looking at visual processing in frogs. And I'll say why we're looking at that in just a second. But it's basically about what the frog's eye tells the frog's brain. Okay, so you're a frog living at the edge of a pond. You need lunch, you need to avoid being lunch. You are relying almost entirely on vision. That is, you're not gonna help, you know, we're not assuming smell, sound, anything else is gonna help you here. So your vision is gonna tell you about the world. So how are you gonna determine what you can find to eat? And how can your vision system help you? If you remember, we said, ideally, vision should produce descriptions, or it should allow us to do interpretations that are useful to the viewer and not cluttered by irrelevant information. That's one of the things Ma said. So what would be useful for the frog to be able to perceive? And what other kinds of information may be less interest or less relevant or be clutter in the frog's vision? So we're going to look at the frog's vision from the point of view of what actually is most helpful and what sort of ways has evolutionary the frog developed that facilitate this. Sorry, I apologise in advance. It's Friday afternoon. It's been a long week. If I get tied up a bit, then just ignore it. I'll move on. Okay, so neurons. Neurons respond selectively. We talked about the other day, we talked about how we might have neurons in different patterns that effectively turn out to be almost like feature detectors. As we said, Hubel and Weisel found that there are patterns of light such as edges and lines. We talked about, sorry, I realised that one's not on. I did press that one. Oh, do I have to do that for both of them? Clearly I do. Okay, sorry, you have them both there, hadn't spotted that. Okay, so neurons fire, they may be designed in such a way they fire according to a particular pattern in the light that's coming in, the particular type of stimulus. We talked about that being their preferred stimulus. And the same neurons will fire maybe less strongly to similar stimuli, but the further you get away from those, the less they fire. Now, it can be that, you know, have neurons in several, there are neurons in several layers, and in particular in the frog's case, that they may prefer stimuli, for example, that are moving. Some may fire to a stimulus moving in any direction, or it may be only certain preferred directions that will cause that to fire. So the goal might be to find out, you know, if you're actually trying to look at this to understand it. I mean, we talked yesterday about the examples of, you know, putting electrodes in cats' brains to see what things fire. And again, so we could do that with humans. You don't actually have to stick it in their brain necessarily. You can stick it on the side. But you're looking to see preferences. And if you're trying to record individual neurons, one of your goals may be to see what is the preferred stimulus for that particular neuron. Is it going to be a particular orientation, or is it going to be movement, or what's it going to be? So research done by Letvin, Maturana, McCulloch and Pitts, they were looking particularly at the frog's retina and looking particularly at single neurons or groups of neurons in the frog's retina. And this is about the same time as Hubel and Weisel, so, you know, a bit of a while ago now, but very influential work on the field. And again, the sorts of things that you can use if you're then building your own sort of artificial vision systems, or if you're trying to look at in order to understand the human visual system. Frogs make good subjects because they have similar visual systems to cats. Simpler visual systems than cats and humans. So the whole thing that's going on is a lot less complex than in humans. And they have different types of cells throughout the retina, so you can look and compare and see how they differ. One of the goals they had there was trying to link the neurology much more to the real behavior. So a lot of the previous work, so for example, the Hubel and Weisel work started out by looking at spots of light. Okay, now you've got a frog, he's in a pond, it's a real environment, you know, is a spot of light the appropriate stimulus? Well, no, there may be other things you want to look for. In real world environments, you may have to think more carefully about what sort of stimuli are you looking for. In this case, it may be dark spots, lines. Maybe you want to have a full color background that you put them on so that you actually make it a bit more real, a bit like the context. In general, when you're doing any of this sort of work, one of the things you always have to decide about is if you want to focus on something in order to understand it better, how much do you strip away everything else? I mean, it's the same in any empirical research you do. You're looking at a particular variable. If you want to focus on that, how do you get rid of the influence of all the other variables in the environment? The answer is if you get rid of them more, it's easier to then to see what the effect is of the ones you're looking at. But the more you remove, then the less realistic the context is. So a lot of research, you'll see there's issues about how much, you know, you cut it down and make it very constrained to the particular lab setting, or how much you try and broaden that to the real world. But then it becomes more complicated. Methodologically, it's much more difficult. You know, experimentally, it's harder then to say any effect you get is due to the things you've been looking at. So that's just sort of an aside here as we're going on. But anyway, in this case, they moved on a bit from like the spots of light to saying, okay, a little bit more complex stimuli that we're going to look at in this. Okay, they had various findings. They found five distinct types of ganglion cells that they called feature detectors. So these were those that seemed to fire when particular features were the stimulus. And each of these seemed to be, you know, most related to particular aspects of the environment. So they found, I mean, again, the detail of this in terms of, you know, learn what the different types of feature detectors are isn't of as importance as much as understanding the general notion of what they were doing and what sort of findings they were making. So they found some that were contrast detectors. That is, if you had a light dark edge in a small area. Convexity detectors, so small dark objects moving on a background. We had changing contrast, so the fact that if something's moving through an environment and the light's changing, then the contrast will also change. A dimming detector that responded to dimming light from the edge or center of the field. And a dark detector related to the overall light density. Okay, so what we're interested just to look at briefly today is the convexity detectors and what they tell us. Turns out frogs are pretty good at detecting convexity. Letvin said, the convexity detector informs us whether or not the object has a curved boundary. If it's darker than the background and moving on it, if it remembers the object when it has stopped, that is, if something stops and keeps moving, ideally you want to be able to have it still firing when, even if it's stopped, if it's already been moving or then keeps moving. If it shows most activity, if the enclosed object moves intermittently with respect to the background, and you would be thinking, okay, why do you think evolutionary this is a good detector for a frog? You know, what is it frogs are most likely to eat as food? Suggestions? Insects, yeah. So this is like a bug detector, primarily. You know, it happens that they have isolated various detectors that seem to be good ones if that's your main food source. So these are features of that that they were able to find. So, as we said, you could go far as to say these seem to be specialized towards big bug detectors. So if you've got stimuli with these sort of detectors that are moving, that have contrast, you know, these sort of stimuli might be good. If we look at, they look more at the responses to single neurons in relation to the convex edge detectors. So if you had a stimulus that's a small, dark, moving object, you got quite a strong response. If it's a stationary object of the same size, then you might initially get a response, but it's tailing off. So if it stays still and doesn't move, you know, in evolutionary terms, then you're probably better eating live food than dead food, or if it's a bug, if it's going to be probably removing. But so you're actually there are going to get an effect where initially you'll get some firing, but then so it will taper off. And this is to say, okay, if you don't have any movement, then you might get a different effect. But the detail of this, as I said, is more, you know, go away and read the papers if you want to know more about this. And we'll be talking about this anyway in this week's tutorial. So the frog paper is what we're going to discuss in more detail. So I'm not going to go into a lot more detail here. Okay, of the three of the five types of frog feature detectors, three of them were actually preferred moving stimuli. It may still be the case that they fire to stationary stimuli, but these are less preferred. And actually even more preferred were sort of more jerky, erratic motions. So not just continuous moving, but moving, stopping, moving, stopping, moving, stopping. And again, as we said, think about it. You know, for a frog, that's actually more likely to be something that better matches the sort of food source. So movement there helps them, in some sense, sort of organize perception in complex and cluttered scenes. So if you think about the pond is a complex and cluttered scene visually. And part of the, you know, you may see it, but part of what you want to do is respond to the things of interest most. So objects, it helps to make objects visible. That is the whole issue of segmenting features from ground. And again, if you start looking at what people have done in machine vision, just trying to get computers to use vision, as well as feature detectors, one of the sorts of specialist bits of kit or code they develop are to do with separating object from ground. You tend in the world to see objects as distinct from the backgrounds. You're doing that as part of the processing. And if you're an object that's likely to be prey, then obviously one of the sensible things to do in this case is freeze. And it's actually something most animals do, is if they're being tracked at one point, you may think, you know, why are they freezing rather than running away? Well, in evolutionary terms, then it may well be that they're less likely to be detected because they're not moving if the thing that's chasing them has detectors that are primarily targeted towards movement. So it's generally useful to perceive motion for several reasons. Several types of motion that may be perceived are real movement, that is when you've got an object that travels across the visual field. So in terms of what we perceive and how we perceive the world around us, that is something that we notice. We notice when things are moving. I mean, the other side of that is if you have something that stops moving and relative to your eye is stationary, you may stop seeing it. For example, you know, you wear glasses, you get a speck on your glasses. Initially, you may notice it, but after a while, you stop seeing it. In relative to your eye, it hasn't moved. And therefore, it stops being a stimulus in that respect. But also, we can have stationary stimuli that are presented proximally, either in space or in time, where we see apparent motion. So we mentioned before the whole thing about, you know, how do you see film? How do you see television? How do you see, you know, how do you perceive 3D motion on a 2D screen? If you get a flip book, you know, and you have cartoons and you flip it and you get the apparent notion of motion from one cartoon picture to the next. These are all to do with, you know, how you interpret motion, but from static images. So as well as real motion, you also perceive and interpret stationary 2D objects, but that you get apparent motion from. We're mostly talking about here real movement, but where the observer is stationary. So how do you starve, you know, we said the other day, how do you starve your pet frog? Okay, what you do is you give it food that doesn't move. You basically give it food on the ground in a dish, or you know, any food that's not moving, because they're not going to see that the same way as they would see moving food. So Maturana and colleagues write them, for the frog, that is for them, a form deprived of movement seems to be behaviourally meaningless. So, and they're not going to perceive it. So the frog has the capability to perceive various types of motion, but not being equipped to detect a stationary source of food. I mean, we don't just see motion, but if you look at other animals and their vision systems, this is one of the things that you find may vary in them. The frog can detect light reflecting on objects, but it's physically incapable of perceiving a small still object, and it lacks the capability to represent that. So the sort of thing we can take from this work and this sort of work is the analysis of the world may begin, you know, in the retina, may begin with, you know, how certain cells fire. So already you've got, you know, preferences and change there. Even the frog's earliest cells in the analysis process analyze the information on different dimensions, that is light intensity, overall illumination, moving edges, curves, contrast. These are all things that they are taking in. So these are actually what you might think of as complex abstractions from the visual image. They're not just primitives, they're not just simple things they're observing. They're actually quite complex in the way that they're combined together. So remember again, the other day we talked about how you can have cells that detect one particular orientation, but then if you look at the convergence of the information coming out of the cells, then you might then start build up. You have number of edges close to each other, and then higher up in the processing, you might be seeing that as a model of an object. So you have the things building up from the lower level primitives. So in this case, for the frog, they build a very sort of more complete representation of things in their world in far fewer steps than we do, but then their world is much simpler. What they need to process is much simpler. Okay, so we've said so far about representations that are built up through successively abstract processing, starting from primitive elements, building these things up. There are some theories out there about how you might get single neurons that code fairly complex stimuli. So not necessarily having to build up from the inputs and outputs of a whole bunch of other neurons. So this is like one of the, you know, you find there are these issues of debate in areas of research. Now in this case, what these tend to get called, referred to as grandmother cells. They're sort of cells that are saying, are there cells that respond to people or objects you are familiar with? Assuming you know who your grandmother is and you have that image as something that's recorded in your memory. So the idea here would be that the neuron is responding to something rather more high level. So for example, a concept rather than just the low level sorts of features that we've talked about so far. And this generally, whilst it might not be a widely accepted theory, there has been some work done fairly recently, it's 2005. So one of the references that you've got to look at in your list of readings is a paper by Quiroga and Al, so the various colleagues. And they are arguing there is some truth to this theory, that there are cases where this may happen. What they're talking about is they refer to it as either the Halle Berry or the Jennifer Anderson neuron. Okay, the idea here is that they gave images, a bunch of different images to people and looked to see whether single neurons fired. And what they found is there were some neurons that responded consistently to a particular individual. Now in this case, the example they use is Jennifer Aniston, because obviously that was popular at the time when they were doing the research, and in 10 years time this research will be less meaningful to people because they won't be familiar with that, which actually also relates to the type of research they're doing, you know, the whole issue of familiarity. What was interesting though is they were presenting images, but they were also presenting various, so in the case of Jennifer Aniston, it was different images from different perspectives, from different times of her, but also there was response also to her written name. And what was actually quite interesting was pictures that showed her together with Brad Pitt didn't get the same response. Okay, it's primarily the ones on her own, different views of that and her name. So in terms of, if you look across, they had a whole bunch of pictures, and if you look at the paper, again, look at it to read to get more detail. But in the paper, you'll see little examples of the various images they showed. And they found that you did get an image response to this bunch of pictures around picture number 30, which were the bunch that were related to her, which were different views of her. They didn't find a neuron that responded to pictures of a number of other famous people, landmarks, or common objects. They did find another one, as I said, that responded to Halle Berry. They found another one that responded to pictures of the Sydney Opera House. Okay, so there were various things that they found that there were responses to. So generally, they found 30 of the 87 images they showed in the paper showed a direct response from a single neuron, but no significantly statistical response to the other 57, yeah.
Is this from the same single neuron that they get the response to Halle Berry and Anne?
No, I think they're different neurons. They look at different neurons.
Okay, and so they said that it responded exclusively to that. How do they know that it's
That's one of the issues. That's an issue, because the question is, does it respond to other things as well? And actually, a few methodological notes. Actually, where they were recording from is closer to the area that's associated with memory primarily than vision. So clearly you would expect memory to be playing a significant role in this. And actually that is one of the issues. So you could still argue that actually it's not because it's a particular neuron specifically that's targeted from the vision perspective. You have to have some connection with the memory neurons for this to happen. And they need to then explore that further and discuss how that works and how that's related. And they're also, as you said, they maybe didn't give enough big enough sample set to find other things that might be responded to. But the paper's attached to the webpage as well, so go away, have a look at that if you're interested, and see a bit more about what they did and how they did it. And think about, you know, exactly those sort of questions, exactly what happened there, what were the flaws, were there ways that could have done differently, are there other explanations? In generally, when you're doing reading and reading up these sort of studies, keep those sort of questions in mind. You know, what other explanations could I come up with for the phenomena they found? Did they do it in a way that I think is sound methodologically, that means that that is the most likely explanation or interpretation that they give? So we're a bit ahead of time here because I whizzed through that a bit more quickly. What I was going to do is, if it works, is just try and show you the couple of videos that I didn't show you yesterday because they're going to get the thing to work. We'll see if they're connected. But we will be, sorry, as I said, coming up next, we will be looking more at this, particularly at the mass in relation to the frog. In the next tutorial, look about a bit more on MAR, look at neurons and firing, looking at a bit more about the frog. And then the lab, what we're going to look at is optical illusions, in particular the Hermann grid and what that can tell us about. We were talking, remember, about how with the neurons you have either you have excitation and inhibitory effects, and how those things also relate to things like optical illusions and what that can tell us about them. So we're going to see now if there is the possibility of getting up the videos that I was going to try and show you yesterday. Of course, it might well have logged me out again by now, which is quite likely. No. Do we have sound?
Nerve cells firing in the anesthetized cat as they presented it with different visual images.
When we started working, Torsten and
I. We can hear something, but I can't work out where the sound control is.
We set up our first experiments, and they didn't go well because at the beginning we couldn't make the cells fire at all. We'd shine lights all over the screen and nothing seemed to work.
I don't know if you can hear that at all.
By accident, one day.
The researchers actually listened in to individual nerve cells firing in the anesthetized cat as they presented it with different visual images.
When we started working, Torsten and I, in the late 50s, we set up our first experiments, and they didn't go well because at the beginning we couldn't make the cells fire at all. We'd shine lights all over the screen, and nothing seemed to work. One day, we were shining small spots, either white spots or black spots, onto the screen, and we found that the black dot seemed to be working in a way that at first we couldn't understand until we found that it was the process of slipping the piece of glass into the projector, which swept a line, a very faint, precise, narrow line across the retina. And every time we did that, we'd get a response.
So can you hear the response, the buzzing of the response there? I know it's a bit difficult to hear that at the back, but did you get the general gist of that? Okay, so there was another couple of examples I was going to show you. So we looked at Freddy yesterday, and this was just another example about computer vision. So this is a little bit longer, but it's basically in relation to... That's better. This is about taking photos of people from different angles.
This week, Lab TV travels to a Navy research lab in China Lake, California, where scientists are teaching computers to recognize images. Every day, the Navy sends airplanes out to patrol dangerous locations. And as they fly, they take millions of pictures. But how can they look through all those images and figure out what's important?
We'd like to be able to send an aircraft or an unmanned aerial vehicle to a certain location and be able to find things. To do that, you have to be able to recognize objects or
so
places.
There's much more general use of these sort of techniques.
Or you have to be able to recognize that's a car, that's a tank, that's a ship. And so that's the whole idea of pattern recognition, being able to recognize things just from an image.
Pattern recognition is also used by computers at the post office when they sort your mail.
The post office doesn't sort mail by hand, you know, the thousands or millions of pieces of mail. They have systems that do optical character recognition, which basically means they take a picture of the envelope and extract out the zip codes, in some cases even the address, and that's how they know where to sort each envelope. Well, this one goes there, this one goes there.
Computers are pretty good at recognizing zip codes, but they have a much harder time than we do with images and photographs.
Our brains do a very good job of being able to recognize people if they are facing us, broadside, looking up, looking down. We still say, hey, that's my friend Bob. Teaching a computer to recognize Bob when it's always looked at Bob straight on, turn Bob to the side, computer says, that's somebody else. I don't know who that is.
That's because computer brains are not as flexible as human brains. So how are the scientists teaching computers? It's all about the math. They're writing math programs to help computers identify the patterns in images of ships, tanks, locations, and even people.
So if we had an image of your face, we'd have a representation, some numbers that represent your eyes and your nose and your chin. And we take all those together and then use those to say, hey, it's a face that we're looking at.
The team is also teaching computers to recognize images with a lot less information. I bet you would have a hard time figuring out this image. It only has 120 pixels.
On your top left, you have your high resolution image, but those are too large. You know, you have too many pixels to work with. So we want to work in this downsample, low resolution domain. So that you're able to still recognize the person, but now we're doing it with less pixels.
The team is also planning to put these programs in robots, so they will be able to recognize images while they do their jobs. This little guy has two eyes, just like a person, so he sees in stereo vision.
Stereo vision works like human vision. The robot has two cameras and two eyes. It can use those two cameras to triangulate on objects so that they know how far away they are. The robots will ultimately be able to identify obstacles in their path, be able to know what the obstacle is, where it is, and how to get around it.
Teaching a machine to recognize images takes a lot of math and a lot of hard work, but it's a big step towards making computers even smarter. To find out more about computer vision, check out labtvonline.org.
Okay, so, and if you look, actually, there are actually a number of videos on YouTube that can tell you a bit about the background and some of the research people are doing. Just to give you an idea of how people have used some of this very early stuff to then build on, to then get ideas for how you go forward in terms of trying to automate vision, or in our case, to try and understand better how human vision works and to test it and to model it. We will stop there. I know it's early, but it is Friday afternoon. And next week, I think you're back to language lectures again. But the vision will be the topic for the tutorial and the lab. Okay? Hi.
I wanted to ask, why did the lecture notes stop appearing on the web page?
Oh, because they were already on there. They were last year's notes. So because we're making some revisions and changes, Henry disconnected them, so we put them up as we go. What I'll maybe suggest to him is we put them back up with last year's, but just say which ones haven't been updated yet.
After the second one appeared.
Yeah, they've actually, this morning he'd actually put up to where we were yesterday back again now, so they should be there for this week.
Okay.
But it was, yes, it was running a bit behind. So, yeah. It was mainly just because I actually can't access easily to put the notes there, so I usually end up getting Henry to do it. But then, what I'll ask him to do is put last year's up with just a note against which ones to say these ones may be changed. So at least you've got an idea to look ahead from. But there are some stuff we're introducing as new, so the notes won't be up there till the week, if that makes sense. Hi. Sorry, what do you mean by generally?
Yeah, general representation.
Representation is very, very broad. Okay, so there is no sort of one thing. So one of the questions is that, you know, when we're actually, if you're solving a problem, you know, you're reading, mm-hmm. what representation do you have internally of what it is you're doing? Mm-hmm. So is it that in your head is somehow a little image of the text? Well, the answer is no, because then you still have to process what the text was. Yeah. What a lot of research done has looked at what sort of representations. So in terms of words, one of the things Hensley will talk about is say, we believe there is some phonological representation in your head, so something that relates to the sounds. But clearly there's also a semantic representation that is relating to the meanings. And there's probably going to be some sort of orthographic representation that is relating to the actual letter shapes and things. And they're probably going to be linked in some way, because clearly if you see a word, you can identify it, say it, and know what it means. But a lot of the big issues in the area are, but exactly how are those things represented internally? And what does that mean in terms of how they work together? And is it that you see it and then you get the sound and then you get the meaning? Well, actually no, because sometimes it doesn't always seem to be serial. It may be those things are happening in parallel. So some of the work on representation in cognitive modeling, a lot of early work was on very much rule-based approaches, trying to devise rule descriptions that said how it worked. And then there was a lot of work that came along that tried to take a much more a neural network approach that was based much more on the sort of idea of neural models that's similar to neural nets, you know, neurons in the head. These days, people often have sort of a hybrid approach where you're saying maybe there's some one, the other, maybe it's combinations in different ways. I mean, the bottom line is we don't know definitively, but we can at least talk about the representations in our ways that may allow us to make predictions about the behavior of a person. Does that give you a bit more idea? Yeah, okay.
Thank you.
Thanks, and you.